and welcome to Countrywide. On the programme this week, we meet a County Clare couple who will celebrate 74 years of married bliss later this month. How do we know what chicken is Irish and what is not? We'll be finding out. Michael O'Leary and Angus Cattle farming and horses, and we go foodie in Waterford. All of this and lots more between now and 9 o'clock. This morning you can reach us on the text 51551, our email countrywide at rte.ie, and we're on Twitter at RTE Countrywide, and of course we're on facebook.com/countrywide.rte. Well, also joining us here this morning is a man that was on this show a couple of times before, veterinary surgeon from Ashburn and County Meath, Pather O'Scannell. Pather, good morning.
Good morning, Damien.
What was it like driving in from Ashburn this morning?
Nobody out except the cows.
And have you had any late nights lately yourself? You're coming out of the busy time now for large animal vets, isn't that right?
We are. We do still get the late nights, but not as much as we used to. In the past, it used to be very common. It's much less now.
Yeah.
Thankfully, I think farms are better organised and farmers are better able to deal with a lot of those crises. But we still get them, unfortunately, Damien, as part of the job.
Well, what have been the big issues on farms in the winter and spring just gone?
Spring is the calvings, the lambings and whatever, but it's more to do with the young stock then. There's a lot more young stock on farms nowadays than there would have been, say, 10, 20 years ago. So calf scars, calf pneumonia is a big one. Lameness in the cows, cattle as well. Cows, dairy cows in particular, would have a lot of veterinary attention required. They are much more pushed now than they would have been years ago and producing a lot more milk than, you know, genetically they're right at their
telling. Is it because farms have become more intensive?
Well, more pressurised perhaps. Intensive is not a word we like to talk about because we talk about Irish farms being extensive, as in outdoors and out on the grazing and whatever, and as natural as can possibly be. But there's no doubt the dairy cow now is producing 2,000 gallons or she's not on her farm, whereas go back a handful of years ago and 1,000 gallons was a good cow. You know, that's unheard of.
And are the cows being pushed too hard, so?
Not too hard, no, not at all too hard, but you have to mind them an awful lot more, just like your Formula One car or your good, you know, I always call them, they're like Formula One cars, those milking cows. They really are at the top of their game. But once minded, and in fairness, farmers are well educated and up to speed on how to mind them. So, like as I said, there's less of the emergency crazy stuff that we used to see years ago and more of the herd health approach as to how to avoid.
And are cows calving themselves now, or are you still doing the odd caesarean here and there?
Oh, we would. We had a caesarean during the week, yeah, we would.
How many layers do you have to go through? This hour of the morning.
Layers, yeah.
No, but it's
the skin.
And all that. It's a lot.
And then into your peritoneum, yeah. And then into your womb. But it's actually a lovely operation to do. I personally love it. I mean, vets do love it. It's a healthy animal. You're dealing with healthy tissue. So you're not dealing with a diseased tissue. There's a great satisfaction, a live calf outside and the calf looking at you, like literally standing up. And the cow, meanwhile, it's done in a standing position and she's absolutely chewing her cud while we're doing the job. It's lovely.
You do it while she waits.
Exactly.
Okay, well, listen, Pather is staying with us. And if you've any questions, if you have any problems with animals or any issues you'd like to ask Pather, 51551 is our text. As I said, Pather's staying with us for the morning. He's going to co-present this programme with me between now and 9 o'clock because, as we know, Irish people, Pather among them, are among the biggest consumers of chicken meat in Europe. But do you know where the chicken comes from? And are we being conned by the labelling on some of the chicken fillet packs that are on sale in butcher shops or in supermarkets? Well, joining me here this morning in studio is Vincent Carton, who's the Chief Executive Officer of Carton Brothers, which owns Manor Farm Chickens. They're based in Shercock in County Cavan, the country's, I suppose, largest poultry processor. Yes. Would you be, Vincent? Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for it. You didn't have as far to come.
No.
Just down the road here in Donnybrook. Firstly, tell me about Manor Farm briefly.
Well, we're a very old family business. I'm the eighth generation who's managing it. We started off back in Dublin, near the Dublin Fruit and Veg Market. And we've since developed our business primarily. We got our poulterer's license way back in the 1800s. And we managed that market for years, which was largely boiling fowl, that is spent hens.
Mm.
And now we're Ireland's largest chicken processor based in Cavan. Yeah.
And I believe overall, not just yourselves, but between all chicken processors in the country, a lot of very small operators, a lot of on-farm organic operators as well. We mustn't forget that. Mm. We were with a friendly farmer in Athenry a couple of weeks ago as well. But we produce 83 million birds every year, apparently.
Yeah, we would process roughly in the 26 counties about 1.5 million birds a week.
And we're importing
Yes,
about 60,000 to 70,000 tons of chicken meat. Why are we doing that?
Well, Irish people love fillet meat. For every 21 fillets sold in this market, there's one leg. So we have a vast amount of surplus.
So is
leg.
There a deficit then in fillets in this country, Irish fillets?
Well, what has happened is the industry has rationalised. So if I go back 17, 18 years ago, we supplied the whole market. Today, over half of it is coming in from abroad.
And how do we know what's Irish and what's not?
Well, unfortunately, neither the consumer nor even I, and I would tend to know my chicken, I can't tell you where it's coming from either. Because unfortunately, the EU food labelling laws are so crazy that, quite frankly, that information is not available.
But if I go into a shop tomorrow and I see Manor Farm, am I guaranteed that that's Irish?
Absolutely, yes. And you'll see the Borbia quality mark with a tricolour built into its logo. That tells you that the hen where the egg was laid, the hatchery where the egg was hatched out, the farm on which the chick was reared, the feed mill in which the animal got fed from, and the processing plant are all based in the 26 counties.
Okay, so the Borbia quality assurance mark is key, is it?
Absolutely.
And again, I just want to make the point that a lot of the small operators and organic operators wouldn't have access to that, but they're still producing quality.
Oh, absolutely.
Department of Agriculture regulated chickens as well, because I remember we discussed this before and somebody said, I don't use any labels at all. I produce my own chicken and sell it in the farmer's market. So,
yeah.
You know, we don't
That's
want
a fair
to be,
point.
Yes,
yeah.
there are a lot of those as well. But then again, as you said, if we go into restaurants or hotels or whatever and we order chicken, the chances are, is that where the imported stuff? I mean, if there's 60,000 tonnes of it coming in, where is it going to?
Yeah, the vast majority of it is going into catering, and that's all forms of catering. I usually ask people, when did they eat Dutch chicken last? And the answer is yesterday, because that's where it's coming from. Now, where do the Dutch get it from? I do not know, because it's all over Europe.
But there's talk of Thailand, that the chicken in Artica chicken sandwiches that we're buying in the petrol stations, whatever, that's coming from Thailand, is that right?
Yes, if you're looking at cooked product and if you're looking at frozen product or products produced from frozen product, yes, you're looking at Thailand and Brazil as major. But by far, when we're talking about fresh chicken, none of it's coming from those places. What we're talking about is coming at the first instance from Holland and before that, more than likely Eastern Europe.
And if I go into a shop and I see a fillet, a chicken Kiev, let's say processed and dickied up or value add, as they call it, with the breadcrumbs and all of that, and it says Irish chicken, although it's actually probably originated in Thailand, once it comes in here and you bread it, it can be called Irish. Is that right?
Yeah, even and I would argue breading is under the terms of the labelling law, which is this term called substantial transformation. I would accept that that is substantially transformed. But if you look at some of the other product that's coming in, it's barely touched at all. Yet that also meets that same requirement. So unfortunately, this term that I've just used, substantial transformation, is an acronym, and it's a what I call a loophole that basically allows an awful lot to happen. And by doing so, a chicken can put an Irish label on it.
Do you want to come in there?
Yeah, Peter? I did. So as a consumer going into the shop, we're not looking to see a label saying this is substantially transformed. We're looking for Irish chicken. So when we say Irish chicken, what's this substantial transformation thing? I mean, that kind of confuses the whole boat.
Well, you and me too, because what it is nothing. It's an irrelevancy in when you look at the actual application of it. One thing I would make the point, that when a product is labelled, at least now you're covered by the labelling law. The product we're largely talking about here is unlabelled. Namely, right. It's either on a plate or it's coming out loose on a counter somewhere. Right. That product is the product we're talking about.
So if you go into a shop and you want to order a chicken sandwich and they've all the little bits of chicken cut up in the deli there, what's the percentage chance that that's Irish?
Virtually nil.
Virtually nil.
Whereas the chicken fillet, if we go into our shop to buy the chicken fillet and it has breadcrumbs or it has garlic sauce added to it or whatever, and it says Irish chicken, has that meat?
There's very little of that being used. There are some, I can think of maybe two or three. I know Superquin do one, and there's a small company down in Clonakilty County, Cork, Shannon Vale Foods, who do local production. But the vast majority of breaded product, from a nugget to a chicken Kiev, would be based on imported chicken fillet meat.
And yet it'll have Ireland written on it?
Yes, because of this.
Well, that's ridiculous now from a consumer's point of view.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
But do you know when we go into the supermarket and it has, you know, Patheros, Scannal, Ashbourne, County Meath, that's real?
That is real. And the reason why that, not only is it real, it's enforced to be real. Because once you make a claim, now the labelling law really kicks in. And there's an awful lot in the provision to say, if you say it, then it must be so. There is some confusion out there when it says Irish chicken and you're talking about the island of Ireland versus the Republic of Ireland.
I don't think too many people worry about that too much.
Well, to be fair, no. Research recently done by Borbia would say a lot of Irish people want to know it's from the south. And the reason is Irishness in food has changed. 5 years ago, it was about provenance, it was about freshness, it was about quality standards. Today, it's about economics. And if I may for a second, if you look at a company like myself, we employ 700 people in County Cavan. We turned over 180 million last year, of which we spent 90% in the 26 counties.
Okay.
And we pay our taxes here. Now, that's what Irishness means today.
And of course, Borbia is a semi-state, you know, funded by the Irish taxpayer. So people like to think that they're not using a label to promote products coming from the six counties.
Well, to be fair to Borbia, they're a European funded organisation, and they must make their system open to those who wish to join. And Northern Ireland Chicken wishes to join that scheme. And to be fair to them, they're the same standard as ourselves. So I have no argument with that.
All right, OK. Now, Adrian Cummins is Chief Executive of the Restaurant Association of Ireland and he's on the line. Good morning to you, Adrian.
Good morning.
Now, it seems that all of these imports from Thailand, Brazil or wherever, they're going into restaurants. Why is that? Is it because your members just can't compete with the Irish product?
I think you need to roll back the conversation there. I think a lot of the imported product is going into the food service area, which is predominantly going into deli counters, supermarkets, and the likes of filling stations where you have catering operations within those. There is an economic factor with regard to the issue with regard to chickens, where imported product is about 25% to 50% less expensive than Irish products. So there is an economic standard there. And we work with Borbia, with our association, encouraging all restaurants to use Irish produce where possible. And there is a campaign out there called Just Ask, where consumers can go into a restaurant and they're asked, you know, ask the waiter where is the produce that's on the menu from.
And he can say it's Irish.
And we can say that it's Irish. Now there is, I think your previous or your
Vincent.
Hit the nail on the head there, where you have produce that's coming into Ireland that has been breaded in big factories and then putting a relabeling it as produced in Ireland or whatever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think we need.
So are you saying that a lot of your members don't? They think it's Irish, but they don't really know. But would they not know because of the price?
I'm not going to name the company, but I'm going to give you an example where there is Dutch chicken coming into this country, and they're reprocessed, and they put a Gaelic name on it, and that's masquerading as an Irish.
Right, so it's fooling consumers.
Exactly, and yeah. I think that's where the likes of the Food Safety Authority, the likes of Borbia, needs to tackle the big mass producers with regards to the labelling issue. It's the same way as the issue of smoked Irish salmon or Irish smoked salmon, which is which, where you have produce coming in from Norway, coming in, being repackaged and masquerading as coming from the Republic of Ireland.
Right.
And, you know, we are in a recession at the moment, and the cost of chicken is far more expensive to purchase than outside of the state.
Okay, well, can I ask Vincent here? Vincent, how much would you be able to supply, you know, chicken fillets to a restaurant for? And then how much are they buying it
from the man
in the white van?
Yeah, I can talk you on the wholesale level. Irish chicken, depending on the size of fillet, is anywhere between 6.50 and 7.50 euros a kilo at cost. Imported fillet today is between 4 euros and 4.20, 4.30 euros, again, based on size. Now, why is the difference so? And I will tell you is loud and clearly, it's because it's stale. This is old product that is surplus production in Europe that eventually finds its way. In fact, research is showing that on average, this product, when it gets here, is day 7. Now, Irish chicken plants will put day of kill plus 7 as the sell-by date. So theoretically, as Irish chicken is coming off the market, this stuff is now coming on. And unfortunately, the Department of Agriculture and UCD here have done trials which shows what I've said to be true, namely, the product does not meet the standards that are coming out of Irish processing plants. We are being very well regulated in this market. Unfortunately, this stuff coming in is not regulated, and it's falling between the stools because, as I said to you before air, we went on air there, Damien, there's five different Irish government agencies involved in the policing and the setting of Irish labelling law with regard to chicken only.
Isn't that the farce itself, Vincent, when all is said? Like, we're missing the whole point. We, as consumers, we're trying to buy Irish chicken. That's undermining the whole thing when you're talking about putting a Gaelic name with Gaelic writing on something and therefore it's Irish and it's not actually Irish at all.
Yes, and I know that pack that he's talking about, it's actually, its colours are in green, white and gold. So, but it comes from Holland.
Okay, Adrian, I'm going to let you go, but very briefly, what's the diagnosis or the prognosis or the prospects for the restaurant industry in 2011?
Not good, Damien. I think there's no light at the end of the tunnel. We met with the Minister for Tourism there last week. We're hoping that the wage agreements will be abolished for restaurants, which penalises all my members by putting an 8% surcharge on top of the minimum wage. It's not looking good, and we're hoping that this new jobs initiative that they're going to announce is going to help our industry. But just putting it into perspective, 1 in 4 jobs in the restaurant industry, 1 in 4 jobs in the tourism industry, they work in restaurants. So it's critical to keep as many people in employment. And we want to work with the producers and the suppliers locally to try and get as much Irish produce into Irish restaurants.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Adrian, thank you very much indeed for talking to us this morning. Okay, Vincent's going to stay with us, Pather's going to stay with us as well, but I'm going to move on to a lovely story, because in about 2 weeks' time, a couple from Ina in County Clare will celebrate a very special wedding anniversary. By the end of April, 94-year-old Kitty and 95-year-old Paddy McGough will have been married for no less than 74 years. Anna Leddy joined this pair of Clare champions and friends as they prepared for their big anniversary.
Will you have a drop yourself?
Me?
Yeah.
I'm a little...
Little drop, yeah.
Okay. Too early.
Huh?
Just a little drop.
Another drop for Anna as well, please. Yeah.
You'd still die your life and doing it yourself?
No.
Oh, you're on Radio Air.
I'm just visiting.
Oh, my God, you're welcome. I think we had someone from Radio Erin before.
I came to visit you last summer.
They did. Two very nice girls. Oh, my God, they were. Because one of them, I remember one of them said to me, "Are we talking too loud for you?" I never heard women talking any other way.
So were you childhood sweethearts?
Yeah. Oh, she was the film star around here that time. Oh, she was very good looking, there's no doubt about that. Nobody else to equal her as far as good looks is concerned.
Kitty, when did you first notice Paddy?
Oh, God bless us. I was the boss when I was 17. He was the only child murderer around at the time.
Can you tell me what you think the secret of a happy marriage is?
To be quiet and listen to things.
The secret of a happy marriage? That's a hard one too, you know. Of course, you'd want to mind yourself when you get married, you know. There's lots of others that might get into your place, and you have always to have your ears and your eyes open. I think Jack Harry, he answered that question better than I would. He was married for 50 years. This old fella, next door, whoever he was, he heard all the commotion and the dancing and the singing and so forth. And he said to someone in the morning, what was on last night, that all the singing and dancing, Jack Garrahy's anniversary, he was married for 50 years. It was too long altogether, he said. Too long altogether. I suppose he was right. You'd want to change now and again. If it was only your shoes, I could take your shoes off and put on another pair and you'd feel better.
I am out.
Romancing all my life. Yeah.
Is Paddy a romantic?
He is. He brings you lovely flowers for your birthday to cheer you up.
Tell me how life has changed for you.
Of course, the health goes, which is a big loss to anybody, I suppose, as well as me. I can't very well walk like I used to or anything like that, or dance or anything. I enjoy a smoke, I enjoy a drink. A man taught me once, you know, there's nothing wrong with drink, he said. It's the amount of time that you spend drinking it. This was, he was right. Going to a public house, a grand evening like this, sit on your arse, but you could be doing something valuable.
Is life a lot quieter than it used to be?
It is, oh, it is. Oh, my God, it is, of course. Look at the population we had some years ago. They're all gone now. There was a nice little village here below always, and they were all very humorous and entertaining and everything, and you didn't feel the time going or something, to be truthful about it. They're all dead now. They were all very nice and great storytellers, travelling around the country that time.
Kitty, do you find life is a lot quieter now? You get fewer visitors?
Oh, Lord, yes. The people got all too well educated now. They couldn't understand what we'd enjoy. It is different now, but we enjoy life.
I don't think an awful lot about old age, only, well, I pray a lot, you know, and I curse a lot too. And I don't know which is the best, but but really, what do you do? Only try and be as good as you can. Sure, we're led to believe that the man above isn't too bad. He let you off fairly lightly at times. I don't know how true that is. I wouldn't know that anywhere.
We are not suffering any pains, only what you'd expect at our age.
Do you have any regrets?
Sure, there is no one, but that's regrets. You regret about some things.
Like what?
You regret you could have done better. You might sometimes regret that you could have better got a better look at a woman if you took your time, you know. Then again, you were very lucky to get the one you got, you see. Putting all the pieces together, the good pieces and the bad pieces.
Kitty, what? How have you put up with this man for 74 years?
Patience. He'll have to sit back and be content.
Well, you've obviously had a very happy life together.
Yeah.
Happy anniversary.
Oh, be good, thank you.
Happy return.
And congratulations.
Thank you, we'll remember you.
Absolutely brilliant. Wasn't that a tonic at this hour of the morning? Well done. That's Anna Leddy there speaking to Kitty and Paddy McGough from Aineen, County Clare, celebrating their 74th wedding anniversary on the 28th of this month. And their family have been wondering if there are any other couples in the country or anywhere who've been married as long, or if they hold some sort of a record. Maybe you could let us know. 51551 or text, or you can email countrywide@rt.ie. Michael O'Leary, good morning.
Morning, Damien. How are you?
I'm not too bad. Will you last 74 years, do you think, of wedded marriage and bliss and all of that?
Absolutely. There's a famous old saying, only the good die young, so I think I'll see 100.
Well, have you been out for your morning run yet? You're probably going to tell us you've a day's work done at this stage, have you?
No, I wish. I have 4 young children now, so the Saturday mornings don't quite get as much work done as I used to.
Yeah, but I know that Saturday is the day when you like to just get out among the cattle and among the horses, is that right?
That's true.
And always has been. You have a big sale next week, Michael.
Yeah, we have the Jigginstown Angus sale. We run it every year, usually on Easter Saturday. And so we're selling, hopefully, 30 very young, very nice young Angus bulls and 15 heifers, with a lot of Canadian and UK, from leading Canadian UK families.
What makes the Angus breed stand out, Michael, from other breeds?
I think it's one of our native breeds. Despite the fact they're called the Aberdeen Angus, it's one of our native breeds. But when we looked at it originally about 10 or 15 years ago, I think it was the fact that, you know, they were, compared to a lot of the continental cattle, Damien, they're very easy calvers, very good maternal instincts. You know, if you're a hobby farmer like me, these cattle are ideal because they largely look after themselves.
Yeah, and of course people say the meat from them is beautiful compared to the concentration you see on the continental animal,
sure.
But the meat is lean and not as tasty.
And wonderful marbling throughout the meat. I think it's why, you know, you go almost nowhere in the United States without it being Angus beef. And I think the Angus beef is increasingly in demand by consumers as the premium beef.
Pather O'Scannell, who's a vet, is here with us, and we have Vincent Carton of Manor Farm as well. Pather, do you want to...
Yeah,
morning, Pather.
Good morning, Michael. How are you?
And very well, thanks.
The two things we love as vets about the Aberdeen Angus, one is the polled, the fact that they're polled, and
true.
Anything that does away with that awful thing of dehorning or sculling, you know,
yeah.
We'd be absolutely for. And the other is the easy calving. But on the easy calving one, a few years ago, the Angus were kind of talking about Canadian traits coming in to make them larger. Do you think there's any fear that they would make them just that little bit too big so that there would then be calving difficulties with heifers?
To be honest, I don't think so, Pater. I mean, we started off originally with about 20, 10 years ago when you could import the Canadian heifers. And, you know, we've never had any difficulty with them. They were slightly larger than the Irish heifers at the time, but we find that those Canadian females crossed to the best of the Irish and Scottish male lines, that we've had no difficulty with calving whatsoever. In fact, I'm surprised that a vet would like easy calving cattle. My experience is the vets like big continentals where you have to be called every time.
No way, Michael. I can tell you I'd leave those behind me easily, no problem.
I can well believe it.
Michael, come here. As you describe yourself there as a hobby farmer, and, you know, over the last few weeks, or whenever we talk here about farming and about the common agricultural policy and all of that, people often say, they talk about the unfairness and say, you know, the likes of Michael O'Leary shouldn't be getting a single farm payment and it's not fair and all of that. What do you say to that?
Fundamentally, I agree. I think the system is a little bit nuts, but, you know, if you wanted a better system, you know, I'm a great believer that ultimately anything that involves government subsidies is doomed to failure. I think we should do away with them all, but I recognise that that's not possible. But it's a bit like the children's allowance. I mean, you know, I have four young children under the age of five, and I can't for the life of me understand why my wife qualifies for four sets of children's allowance. I think at a time when we have increasing difficulty, it's very hard to justify very rich people qualifying for these grants. I think there should be a better way of allocating them.
Because the average, I think, it's out there in the public domain. I think Jigginstown got something like 70 grand 2 years ago when it was published. But, you know, the average Irish farmer is getting less than 10,000, you know, and it's skewed in that regard.
True, you know, and I think that the more, you know, we have about 900 acres here. So, you know, the more they relate it back to land, the more it kind of, you know, I think it helps people who don't need the help and probably disadvantages smaller farmers. I don't think the system is right, and I think that's why, you know, food prices tend to be on average that little bit higher here in Europe than they are compared to the US.
Yeah, you had a great Cheltenham, Michael.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and, you know, an emotional one too. People remember, you know, how you dedicated, I think, was it the first win to your dad? How is he keeping?
You know, like a lot of families, you know, he's had a diagnosis of cancer. It's quite advanced, so, you know, there isn't, I don't think there's any chance of recovery. But as he says himself, you know, he's 78 years of age. He said he's not going to leave too many boxes unticked. I think as long as he doesn't suffer pain and doesn't have to undergo an operation, I think he's quite well attuned to it. So it's an emotional time for the family, for my mum. You know, and I think whatever time he has left to him, as long as he can be pain-free, I think, like a lot of other families in similar situations, I think that says we'd all be very happy.
And did he enjoy First Lieutenant and the other two winners as much as you did?
I don't know. Well, I think he did. I think he got a great lift from it. He called me afterwards and said, you know, if you're going to announce on national television that I have cancer, the least you could do is don't blub about it. So I have to behave myself in future.
Ah, yeah. Well, look at it. You know,
it was a great day.
Yeah, absolutely. What about, are you any horses going anywhere today? The Scottish National's on today, isn't that right? Nothing there, no?
Nothing there. Well, jump racing in Gorn tomorrow. I mean, the next big meeting here will obviously be the Grand National meeting in Fairy House on Easter weekend, and Punchestown the following week.
And what about Fairy House? What have you going there, Michael? Any tips for us at this stage?
We hopefully would have beautiful sound going in the Grand National now. I think he's low down in the ballot, so he'd need a lot of horses to come out to get in. But I think if he gets in, he'll give everybody a very good run for his money. And if you want one at a big price, we have a very nice horse called Westmead who runs somewhere either in Punchestown or in Fairy House. He didn't run well in Liverpool last week, but I think he'll be a decent price, give people a decent run for their money.
Yeah, I heard you on with Ray Darcy saying you had high hopes for him last Friday.
I said to Ray, I have very high hopes for a horse called Westmead, and I probably doomed him now. And then he slipped at the start and hit the third last and had to be pulled up. But yeah, we think he's very nice.
By the way, just on that, before I let you go, Michael, I mean, the Grand National last week, and I love horse raising. Pather here, very much involved in the equine industry. But sitting down watching the Grand National, I just felt, I had a bad feeling at the end of it with the two horses being killed, with that young jockey, Peter Toole, getting badly injured as well. And then looking at the winner at the end with them throwing buckets of water over the animal and everything, it just came across, it just didn't feel right, a bit cruel. What's your own view on it? Is it a race that needs to, are there too many horses? Is it too long? Are the fences too high?
Honestly, I think the problem in many ways is a victim of its own success. You know, in recent years, they've been kind of lowering the fences and making them easier. So you're getting a lot more ex-flat horses running. And the ground, I think, was probably too good. They're just going too fast. What people misunderstand, you know, they think horses are dying because they're exhausted. You know, the two horses that were killed, one fell at the fourth fence and the other fell at the sixth fence. You know, like, the jumping horses occasionally break down. It's the tragedy of jump racing. Yeah. You know, but I think we need to put it in some context. You know, compared to, say, the tragedy that befell Peter O'Toole, the young jockey, you know, they are horses. This is what they're bred for. No different to, you know, I think people misunderstand you could lose a cow calving. Yeah. You know, it is nature's way. I do think racing...
But is it nature's way that they're racing? I mean, I know, I'm not getting... Okay.
It is, and to see...
I mean,
Pather, you Michael, know more about it than
you.
I do.
Well, I agree completely with you, Michael, and the horses actually love their game, and they're trained for it, and they love it, and you tell a horse, no, you're not going to race anymore, you can stay in the field, you can stay in the stable, you break the poor fellow's heart. They do love it, and you're dead right, Michael. It's a lot of the injuries are occurring because of some accident, and that accident could occur at home on the home farm or on the home gallops, and it's not exhaustion to stop them. It was, I agree with you, Damien, the kind of throwing the buckets of water there looked a little bit crazy, and in Fairy House we had a meeting there last week of our own vets with the manager as to what we're going to be doing, and really throwing buckets of water is a bit of a cod, spraying them with some water on any of them that do, and to remember as well, it often isn't just exhaustion, it's actually heat. They're building up massive heat because of the muscle exertion, and it is cooling them down. To put water on them is what they need. That's primarily just a chance.
I do think maybe the way forward in Aintree though would be to just simply water the ground to make the ground slower. You know, most jumping accidents happen because of the horses that tend to be going too fast. You know, horses will hunt around, as you know, hunting here locally. They'll hunt for 4 hours in bottomless ground, but they're just not going as fast as they are in something like a race in Aintree.
Okay.
But I think people do need to have a little bit more of a more balanced approach to it.
All right, Michael, just one brief question for you. I was in Wexford during the week recording an interview with Margaret Jeffers, who's the founder of Good Food Ireland, and I'm going to put it out in a couple of weeks' time. But what she's trying to do is promote food tourism. She says, we have it all here. If we marry our food and agriculture to our tourist potential, we can get visitors in here. What do you think of that, as somebody in the tourism sector to an extent and the farming sector?
I think it's a very good idea, but you know, the difficulty is it's quite a limited market. I think, you know, tourism is a very broad brush industry, but it's an industry that will respond very quickly here in Ireland to a bit of stimulus. But I think anything that helps tourism, you know, I think we are going back to the warmer welcome for our visitors, and whether it's food tourism, sports tourism, any kind of tourism at all, you know, we're working at the moment with government to try to get rid of the tourist tax. We have a plan to bring millions of more visitors to Ireland, and I hope the new government will work with us.
Okay, and finally, out of 10, 37, 38 days into this new administration, what would you give the government?
Too early to say yet. Like, frankly, I think we'll have to wait until we get to the first 100 days. We see what the jobs budget is like. But, you know, I think they've had a promising start so far, but then they have huge goodwill. You know, because I think everybody was so keen to get rid of the last mob. But, you know, the country is in very serious difficulties and we're all going to have to work that little bit harder for the foreseeable future. But if we all put the shoulders to the wheel, like the farmers of Ireland, I think we'll succeed.
Okay, listen, Michael, thanks indeed for talking to us. Good luck with
your
sale.
Damien.
By the way,
thanks,
the Carrick and Shannon Angus sale is on today, and good luck to all there. And somebody says
for
Irish
sure.
Angus, the best cattle, and as you said, the tastiest. Good luck, Michael. Thank you
thanks,
very much.
Damien.
All right,
Patter.
Bye-bye. Now, a load of questions. Vincent, you're still with me. Sam says, I make sure to buy south. I want my cash and my VAT to stay here, not to go elsewhere. Damien, do any of your guests know how welfare standards and chicken rearing in Thailand compare to those in Ireland?
Yeah, they're variable. However, the product that comes into the EU has to meet certain minimum standards. Now, it wouldn't be quite up to the European standard, but those Thai factories that sell in here do. That being said, I have to say they don't have the ban on antibiotics in feed, and some of their housing, I would argue, is not great.
And what about here? I mean, are welfare standards, are you happy that they're good here as well?
Yes, I am. I am happy. They're well regulated, and also we have the Board Beer scheme to back it up, so it's audited as well. So yeah,
okay.
I'm quite happy with that.
All right, a lot of things I want to get through, so I'll be as brief as I can. Should a free-range chicken be injected with water or whatever, as when I cook mine there's a lot of fluid in the dish? That's for Marie.
Yeah, well, the fluid in the dish that they're talking about there is largely fat. And the reason is a free-range bird is from a northern climate bird. That's its breed. It's a slow-growing breed. And they traditionally have higher fat levels.
Okay. Now, Irish-breaded chicken or breaded Irish chicken?
Yeah, smoked salmon issue again. It's the same problem. Yeah.
Okay. What does free-range chicken mean?
Free-range is actually covered by law. It means that the bird must be reared in a certain type of housing that has basically little pop holes, little doors to let it out. The birds stay indoors until day 28 when they've lost their down and they're now feathered properly. And then, by law, they must have a space outside four times the size of the internal space in form of paddock in which they can roam. And finally, they cannot be killed before day 56.
Okay, all right. Now, Pather, to a few questions for you. How do I get rid of pock, ringworm? From Sean.
Well, pock is obviously it's a local word. I never heard that one before. But ringworm fungal infection, it's difficult enough. And there is a vaccine available. There used to be an in-feed powder, but that's gone now at the moment. And there is a wash available, but it's the vaccination would be the best way if you had a whole batch of them.
Okay, what are the best ways to prevent calf scour?
Well, the first thing, and that's really where we're at now as vets, is identify what the causal problem is. And then it varies right across the board as to how you're going to get rid of it.
I think Fintan Graham, your colleague, has a piece in the journal this week inside the back page on calf scour. Is that right?
Yeah, Cryptosporidium in particular, yeah.
Cryptosporidium. Okay, so it's from the water?
Well, crypto can come from the water, but crypto can come from the dam. She can have some and she can be passing it on and the calves will pick it up fairly early on. But crypto is a particular one and it's one that we see more recently. It's not something we saw quite as much of in years gone by. But there's rotavirus, as you call it, there's salmonella. There's a whole load of them out there. But the big thing really
But it can
is,
be treated.
Absolutely. Identify it and prevent it.
Okay, Pather, why would a healthy two-year-old heifer never come in heat?
She might be twin to a bull. She could be free Martin. Twin to a bull means that, he may have bought her, whoever the caller is, may have bought her and not realised that when she was born, she had a twin and the male and the female, it upsets the poor old female and 85% of them just won't breed.
Right, so no hope.
No hope if that's what she is.
And how will he know?
Veterinary diagnosis, someone left a
handle okay.
Her, yeah.
For free, of course.
Absolutely.
A calf with white scale on one eye, what should I do?
I'd have to ask the question, what's white scale?
Okay.
On one eye?
All
is
right.
It a clouded eye? Or is if it's clouded eye, is it trauma? I don't know. Yeah. Is he talking about corneal opacity or is he talking about some damage? Again, get someone to have a look at it.
Okay. What is the cause of extra sickled legs in calves?
Now, shin count. Ear or a muscle, I might have an answer for you.
Okay. I have a calf 3 days old. He will not suck his mother. He will suck a bottle. How do I change this?
Well, the thing is, rear them on the bottle if you're having huge difficulty and can't get the mother. Sometimes the mother can be very fractious and she can have a painful udder and won't allow it. But I mean, could he not get a bucket with a teat on it and just feed her on?
No, he is using the milk from the mother. He milks the cow and uses her milk to feed the.
Right.
It's just a very.
If it's very difficult
it's
for
a very particular calf.
It is, isn't it? It doesn't like the taste of the mother's milk.
Okay, can I go back? A lot of people talk about that they use free range chicken and they support Irish chicken and all of that sort of thing. Okay, I might come back to one or two of those. But the Waterford Festival of Food takes place this weekend in Dungarvan and they've a really great and imaginative lineup. Of food and cooking events, not to mention the local history and entertainment. And Francis had a report on Drive Time yesterday evening about it. But Donal O'Sullivan has been to West Waterford to meet some of those who will be taking part. And our first stop was to Knockanore, where Thomas Baldwin, who makes Baldwin's Farmhouse Ice Cream.
We farm about 120 acres and we have about 70 cows filling about 85,000 gallons of milk quota, and we're mainly just a dairy enterprise. We don't do any beef.
And what attracted you to the ice cream business? How did that develop?
It was funny actually. In 2005 I won a scholarship trip to Holland and Belgium, and on that trip we visited a number of dairy farms, and on one particular farm they obviously had cows, dairy cows, and they were making ice cream. And from then on, I showed an interest and just looked into funding and basically got set up in 2006. What you're looking at for ice cream is getting a high fat content in the milk, obviously, to make as much cream as possible. But the normal, everyday commercial cow is still good enough for ice cream. Some companies use Jersey cows, but we've just a kind of a British Friesian Holstein herd and it seems to do fine.
Did you have enough spare milk, though?
If you cast your mind back to 2006, milk price was actually very low. So there was a lot of talk of doing alternative enterprise on farm to basically boost your output and boost your income. So the ice cream itself will only take a percentage of my milk quota. So I'm still sending in most of my milk quota to Glanbia.
OK, let's step over the straw then and have a look at
it. We will. We'll have a look at the plant. OK, Donna.
Step into that.
The Crocs, they were the best thing I bought, actually, them. I used to be wearing normal shoes and I found at the end of the day making ice cream, your feet would get real sober. These things seem to be the business. They're just comfortable and clean. Okay, Donna, we're here now in the ice cream plant, and basically it's like one big kitchen, and it's set up in such a way that on our left here we have the raw ingredients, so you have your cream then from the previous evening or even that morning's milking. Mm-hmm. So you both have your milk and your cream in the big fridge, and as well as that then we use egg yolk, which is a natural emulsifier. So we proceed to the table over here where we mix all the ingredients by hand. It is mixed and pasteurized to about 84 degrees. And the difference between this and probably other ice creams and other processes is basically you're using raw milk and raw cream, and it's both mixed and cooked and pasteurized at the same time. So you really get that unique flavor, and no flavor is lost.
You do a lot of tasting, so
I have to do a lot of tasting. Unfortunately, yeah, it goes with the job, I guess.
Do you have help with this?
My parents are on the farm, and they basically, Dad does a lot of the farming, most of the farming in fact, and Mam helps out both on the farm, and she does all the labelling for me and the ice cream. So it's a very much family unit, and I bring in help then from the outside part-time help.
I left the hills of Knockanore and headed for the coast to meet up with Marie Power and Grace O'Sullivan on Kilfarracy Beach to hear all about the delights of collecting seaweed.
We have a species called Himentalia elongata. That's the sea spaghetti. We have a beautiful one here, another of the kelps. It's called sugar kelp. Now, the critical thing in collecting seaweed is to harvest sustainably. And what we mean by that is that you never pull it from the holdfast, the kind of rooting system. So they're sea plants, like sea vegetables, so that you harvest it without destroying the whole variety that's there.
So Marie, with my harvest, how do I store it?
The seaweed that you bring home from the beach will be wet. It'll have seawater on it. And the first step is to put it into your hot press, either hang it or lay it on trays. And that means that you can store that then for up to a year or two even, so that you don't have to be coming to the beach every week, you know, your stock will last you for a while.
And how do I turn it into something really delicious and edible?
You can add that into soups, risottos, curries, stews. You can sprinkle it on top of a poached egg. If you use a variety of seaweeds, you'll be getting a broad range of nutrients as well. If we look, say, at the dillisk here, and this dillisk is very popular in this area in summertime. When that dries, it becomes a sort of chewy, rubbery sort of texture, and you can literally just snack on it as you would a packet of crisps maybe or something like that. It's really rich in iodine and other nutrients. When we were children, people used to take this one, the slowcon, right? This is the one the Japanese wrap their sushi in. But that, as you can see, that looks a bit like spinach or cabbage, yes? And you can boil that up, and the diehards around here would just boil that and eat it as a vegetable on a plate.
Grace, tell me, why is it so important that we should recognise the value of seaweed?
It's full of protein, calcium, magnesium. In addition, you have iodines, low in calories, so it's a good slimming food, which people might be surprised about. Like last night, I had a load of rice left over from the day before from a meal, So I cut up a type of seaweed called Alaria, and I just shredded it in with some carrot and stock cube, and it was absolutely delicious. And it's mad to think that this is all freely available. It's wild species, you know, this is wild food on our seashore.
And you can also use it, of course, in the bath. The one you're looking at here is the serrated rack. You would put that in your bath, rub it on your skin, and it keeps you young looking, keeps your skin soft, takes out all the toxins, and it even gets rid of cellulite. We won't show you the evidence, but it does.
Yeah, that's Don O'Sullivan reporting there from Dungarvan, where the food festival continues this weekend, and lots to look forward to there today and tomorrow. Now, Pather, here we go. A weanling born on April 2010 scanned yesterday in calf, 6 months to a bull weanling, also born in April 10. Need advice, please, the best thing for them.
Well, there must be a law against that in the country. They're only 6 months old when she went in calf. But in fairness, his vet would best advise him. But you know, some of those will actually give birth naturally. It's amazing that nature does look after itself, even though we allow these mistakes occur. Nature will look after herself. And I would say that she's way too far to be talking about doing anything else except let her do naturally.
Okay, and Mary Lennon says, how do you anaesthetise the cows for a caesarean section if they're standing?
They're done as local anaesthetic. They're done under local anaesthetic only. So they're done in standing position. It makes it a much easier operation on her, and it makes it a much easier operation to perform. When they're down or under full anaesthesia, that's a different, it's much more difficult operation.
All right, okay. And somebody says, Connor rings in, says, will you ask Michael O'Leary if he wants to buy a horse that can have a 10-minute turnaround between races? Okay, listen, I want to thank you both very much for coming in. And next week, we have a very special Easter Saturday programme live from Borbee in Dublin. Nevin Maguire will be cooking us a full Irish breakfast, and we'll be talking to the farmers and producers who supply us the rasher, sausages, eggs and so on. And we'll have a panel discussion about small Irish food producers. That's the countrywide Easter breakfast with Nevin Maguire next Saturday morning, live from Borbee headquarters. Do tune in. That's it for this week. My thanks to Vincent for coming in, and also to Pather for dropping by, and also to you for listening. Tom Nolan was on sound. Brian Lally produced. The final whistle is gone.
And the game is over now, obviously, man. What a victory. Oh, mother of God, there'll be a big night in the Glen.